Where to begin? Well, it's called House.
Yes. Well, this is discursion number two.
Yeah.
And yes, the film that we're discussing at this time is called House, or Haozu.
Yeah. And I was just reading in the viewing notes, it's the director Obayashi's first feature. After spending some time in TV and commercials and sort of independent experimental film.
Yeah, so we should set that this is 1977.
Yeah.
This film's been relatively recently released as in the Master of Cinema series. Yeah, so 1977. Yeah, if you're in America or the UK, you're seeing what Star Wars and Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
Yeah.
What other big films are there in 1977?
Well, there's big blockbusters that are probably very big in Japan as well, I'd imagine.
Yeah. Whereas this... Well, I suppose we should... I think it's going to be impossible to discuss it without spoilers.
Yeah.
So that should be a warning for anyone who hasn't seen it. But it's... How to describe it? It's...
Well, it's a horror film. I suppose if we were to put it in a genre, that's maybe the closest.
It's a comedy horror.
But it's got other things going on as well, hasn't it?
Yeah. It's some sort of cross between a horror film and a Saturday morning children's telly.
Yeah, children's or maybe like teenage.
Yeah,
teenage flick.
Yeah,
yeah.
So there was now. Yes, we should probably briefly outline the narrative, such as it is, which involves. Well, it has quite an elaborate backstory about the main character,
yeah.
Who's called Angel. Although one that I've seen elsewhere referred to as Gorgeous, so I'm not sure about the translation in that point. But and she's looking forward to going to the country, I think, for the weekend with her father. But then it turns out that. He in fact has a new girlfriend who he's going to marry, or possibly has married, and she's upset about this, and then plans to join the rest of her friends who are very excited about travelling. They're going off for the weekend camping with their male teacher, a group of. I mean, it's not a boarding school, but it looks like a fairly exclusive school that they go to. Do you think?
Yeah, possibly. It's quite a large building, and it seems to be an all girls school.
It's an all girl, and they're in very sort of. Western, well, it seemed look to my eye sort of Western school uniform.
Yeah.
And they're sort of mid-teens, aren't they?
Yeah.
Sort of youngish teens. Although there seems to be a range of ages. I mean, the actual actresses seem to be a range of ages, but they're assumed to be in the same class anyway. So Angel is upset about. She's upset about this prospect of a new mother and decides instead to go off to stay with. Her aunt in her house, who she's only ever met once in her life.
Correct, when she was very young.
When she was about six or so. But she sends her a letter and then gets a reply saying, please come along with a white cat.
Yeah, if this is sounding bizarre, we're not even into the...
We haven't even got to the strange bit.
The minefield that is the house.
So they all travel off to the house and it turns out that the... aunt is a ghost and the house eats them all, and that's broadly the plot.
Yes, yeah. So is there a bit of a parallel between how Angel is feeling and how her auntie is feeling with regards to marriage, because they're both alienated to some extent, because Angel doesn't like the idea of her father meeting someone new. And there's a suggestion that Angel's aunt, who lives in the countryside, is sort of a bitter widow. Is that fair to say?
Mm.
Her husband died in the war.
Yes.
And
her fiance is killed as a World War II fighter pilot.
And she became a cat lady, essentially.
Yes, she becomes literally a very crazy cat lady. Yeah. Well, she appears to be, there's the references to, well, she's some kind of witch, I suppose.
Yes.
The exact details of the sort of mythology, it's not clear to me whether they're not clear in the film or whether it's possibly alluding to sort of Japanese traditions of ghost stories and things that we're not quite au fait with.
Yes.
And oh yes, and it should importantly be mentioned that it's very much it's the protagonist, this group of girls who are all sort of Seven Dwarfs style, are labelled and characterised according to their particular, not quite personality types, but their sort of
their attributes,
their skills. Yes. Yeah. So we have Angel. We have, well, her best friend Fantasy, who is the one who first spots strange things are going on, but in good, crying wolf style, is not believed because she's an inveterate fantasist anyway. There's one called Prof with glasses to indicate her intelligence. Who else do we have? We have Melody, importantly.
I'm just seeing how many you can remember.
I think I can remember them all. There's Melody, who's the musical one. There's one called Sweetie, who appears to be the youngest, and I think is what into dolls and things. She appears to also enjoy housework. There's who else is there? Kung Fu. There's Kung Fu, who's important. Yes, does what it says on the tin.
And one has more.
Oh yeah, that's right. There's Mac, who's the one who is interested in nothing but eating.
Yeah.
And apparently she's called Mac because it's the second half of the English word stomach.
Yes.
So yeah. And they all die in appropriate ways. So it has something of the Charlie and the Chocolate Factory.
Yeah.
Structure, except that it doesn't seem that they, like the Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, and in fact things like the Saw films, where people die, the sort of punishment fits the crime. They die in ways that fit their sort of sins. But this isn't the case. It's just they die in ways that match their, like you say, their attributes or their personalities.
It's not a morality tale.
No. Yeah, what is it? I've been saying...
Well, I suppose maybe one reason they're all given specific attributes is because there's another genre element of which we're not entirely aware, I suppose, a sort of teen movie kind of ensemble cast where you
absolutely
have relatable characters. And I was looking at the viewing notes, and there's a poster on the back of the Masters of Cinema booklet that has the House Girls, which suggests that they had some... enjoyed some popularity after the film ended, as sort of,
or at least that was the idea.
That was the idea teen icons for a little bit.
Yeah. I suppose the most striking things of the film overall are sort of, stylistic issues, I suppose, in sort of a number of ways. I mean, I don't know if we should talk about the visual style, which is extremely... Well, the whole film is sort of extremely excessive. So there are a number of effects which sort of give the impression almost of being computerized, but I'm not quite sure how much that could have been true at this point. Maybe possibly some very early, computer effect, but I think also more sort of elaborate, all sorts of elaborate kind of matting and superimpositions of all kinds. Which
it's funny because you mentioned Star Wars.
Yeah,
and that Star Wars has, if you like Star Wars and if you've watched Star Wars, has quite a specific texture to it, and here the effects, as you say, are all they're all quite distinct in texture, and they seem to have been created using various methods because there's bits of animation
well. Bits of dismembered bodies floating around at various points. And
stop motion.
Particularly the things when Melody's eaten by the piano. That's a very kind of elaborate sequence with the piano.
Yeah.
Swallowing her up. But I think those are maybe the most obvious. But there are some other I think some of the most interesting visual things are actually quite early on. There are some quite sort of, I wouldn't go so far as to say subtle, but their effects. So the very first scene when Melody and Fantasy are in the appears to be their school chemistry lab, I suppose. But their Fantasy is taking photos of Melody, sort of dressed up as in a sort of old-fashioned kind of Japanese wedding bride's outfit. But there's a sort of frame within a frame effect Which then, so both the outer frame and inner frame are sort of showing the classroom, but sort of different parts of the classroom. But then the inner one pans, and then that's sort of pans to the left, and at one point eventually it then matches up with the outer frame.
Yeah,
which is, as I said, like, subtle is not quite the right word, but it's sort of it's not like the later things, which is a sort of, it's already over the top in some sort of way, and it seems entirely gratuitous. I'm not quite sure what the point of it is, other than as an interesting effect, but it is actually, you know, well executed, and the kind of it's visually interesting.
Yeah,
and there's bits later, like other sort of small things, but still in the early part of the film, where there's a bit where Angel goes up some stairs, I mean, steps, you know, outdoor steps, and then there's a cut to her opening a door, and the horizontal of the door is exactly matched with the horizontal of the buildings. So there's a sort of, initial impression is this complete kind of madcapness and sort of doing anything for the sake of it, which I think might be right. But there is an attention to, detail.
Mm, some individual shots are quite moving, actually.
Are they?
Well, yeah, I thought so. And maybe it's just me being a softie, but I quite like the use of slow motion in the film, which is very, compared to a lot of the animation effects, is quite unobtrusive.
Right, right.
I think. So, for example, where the... I can't remember her name, but essentially the new mother...
Right.
Angel's father's bride to be enters, and there's some slow motion and a close up and slow pan, and they have, you know, they have the sort of wind effect, and her hair is blowing around.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I don't know if you remove it from this film and place it in a film by another director, you could see it as...
Well, that's it. I mean, to pin the tone down seems to be really quite hard, because it seems to be relying on... I don't know, it's a bit easy in a way to say, oh, well, it's sort of Japanese, so there are possibly conventions that we're not quite familiar with, but it does
seem...
Which is
important to say.
Yeah, I think that's true. But it's also clearly not... it clearly is sort of comic, and there clearly is a sort of excess which is comically excessive. You know, I mean, there's the most elaborate sequence of a potential rescuer appearing eventually and then not actually rescue anyone outside of The Shining, which of course was after this, but you know the long sequence of Scatman Crothers trying to reach them, and then he finally gets there and then is axed in the chest immediately. There's a sort of parallel to this with their school teacher who can't initially go with them, has to come the next day, and so you keep cutting away to him attempting to get to the house and encountering all sorts of ridiculous obstacles, and then eventually almost gets there, speaks to the fruit seller who the girls also spoke to earlier. Well, he sells watermelons. The teacher says he doesn't like watermelons, and the next time we see him, he's been turned into... He says what he does like is bananas, and he's been turned into an enormous pile of bananas, which is the most... I don't know what to make of it, but...
Yeah.
It's clearly...
It's like stream of consciousness, almost.
Yeah.
The flow of ideas there.
Well, that's it. So the question of how much the film is in control of what it's doing seems to be... Because it does give the impression sometimes that it's not in control of what it's doing.
Sure.
And it's just being ridiculous. But then there are all these... Yeah, quite, careful... a sense of careful attention to all sorts of things. Even down to... There's a sequence after... Melody has been eaten by the piano, when this particular theme, which is played constantly through the film, is still being played, but just by her severed fingers. But just to say, there's a shot of the piano keyboard with these severed fingers magically sort of picking out the melody. But just the fact that what they play is exactly right. You know, they do actually play the tune that you're hearing. Like, that seems to be a level of attention to detail that's not necessary,
Yes.
I mean, in heaps of films, and even films that would have cost vastly more than this, they don't actually bother to match what a musician is playing to what you actually hear. But they've bothered, in this case, to animate in some way and get it spot on. So
you're right. There's an earlier shot before Melody. This film maybe will, one way of looking at its structure is before and after Melanie is eaten by the piano. So memorable is that event. Melody. There's a scene in which she's playing the piano and there's a slow pan around the piano, and you see the which is quite delicate movement, and then you see the skeleton dancing in the background, which is just like a nice kind of hint of
when there's humor. Another moment in between those where, because she's turned on the metronome and they've set up a motif of her and occasionally another character sort of rocking back and forth like a metronome, and there's a long sequence where all the girls are sat at the piano and Melody is playing it, and then the camera pans right and left again, you know, mimicking the metronome.
There's a logic to it.
But there's also a sort of playfulness, and that's obviously a sort of excess which is intended to be noticed. I mean, that's a relatively more subtle example than some of the other ones the film has, but it fits in with its general way of behaving. But like you say, it doesn't quite seem. Presumably, it is also intended to be frightening in places, and it probably would be if you saw it at the wrong age or the right age. Yeah, it could be. I don't know. What do you think?
I think it dwells on the horror long enough to suggest that it's trying to frighten us. It's trying to make us think about. Mm. I don't know, the pain of Sweetie caught in the clock, that's quite a long take, I don't know, you have those close-ups on Melody caught in the piano where her severed fingers are brushing against the piano strings. So yeah, I do think that's gruesome, but I think it also is horrifying. It's just how it dwells on those. But
I think thinking then makes it make more sense, sort of as you were saying, that some of the sentimental sort of excess is also perhaps being played more straight than, I mean, being played to the hilt, but in a sense being played straight. I don't feel straight is quite the right word. But, I mean, so towards the end of the film, after almost everybody has died, there's a kind of sort of sentimental song which doesn't appear to have anything kind of tonally to do with the rest of the film, but it seems to make sense, or make most sense, if it is, in some sense, meant to be working as a sort of moving song, you know? Kind of, you know, like knowingly cheesy, but not sarcastic.
Yeah, the film moves quite briskly from tone to the next.
Savagely, we might almost say.
You might say, because there are some jump cuts as well, I think, that are noticeable. But it also, the film is willing to layer different sequences together in ways that are incongruous, to suggest that some scenes are being played straight and some are meant to be horrifying, and that the incongruity that makes you anticipate, you know. So you have the scene where I think Angel is taking a bath, or one of the characters is taking a bath, and you have two other characters, you know, wandering around the house being drawn by various sort of ghostly goings on into booby traps. And so, yeah, there's a mixture of tones happening simultaneously, as the tone shifting overall throughout the film.
That's true. It does also have this sort of playful. I mean, there are also quite a lot of self-referential elements as well, I think, and sort of. I mean, there's a bit where the Angel's father is supposedly a sort of famous and successful film composer who's just got back from working on a film and in Italy, and he made a comment about how both Leone and Morricone were pleased with his work, you know, which is obviously something for the film fans and the audience. But there's also a moment I like when they get off the bus, when they sort of almost arrived at the house, and they're in front of a painted
flat, like a sort of, yeah, a kind of painted flat, which is, I don't know if it's, that's meant to be sort of a bus stop or an advertising hoarding or something, which is a painting of hills and a blue sky and a sun, but which is obviously meant to exist in the film world. But then you sort of cut and you see the countryside in which they're in which there's very obviously, you know, a cinematic flat showing exactly the same thing in the background. So there's, you know, there's also deliberate sort of...
It's a visual gag, is it?
Yeah, I suppose.
I mean, that's... yeah, that's that. I noticed that as well. You move into the billboard and there's a confusion about whether it's still the billboard or whether it's acting as the background. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, because the whole style is so unrealistic in the first place that you don't and there have been sequences on the train where the passage of the train from the outside has been represented by sort of almost kind of paper cutout and its style, very flat, yeah, animation. So you'd be prepared to sort of accept that this obvious artificial flat was nonetheless representing the setting, but then you find out that it exists in the setting, but then the thing which represents the reality of the film world is just as unconvincing, and you're allowed to see both of them at the same time. So there seems to be some deliberate play with those things. Mm. I think that's the whole thing about how much it's in control. It sort of wrong foots you kind of continually. If you start to, you know, dismiss it, it does something which is actually quite careful. And then if you think that, oh, okay, this is all some, you know, masterfully controlled ironic, then it sort of, you know, does, I don't know, devolves into too many shots of scantily clad, you know, pubescent girls, and you think, you know,
yes.
No, it's not in control of what it's doing, or at least, you know, what it's trying to do is not.
It's not all about. It's not an experiment in film form.
No, no, but it does experiment. You know, or does it just use? Is it that the director's more interested in the particular moments? I mean, that would make sense. So there are actually some really quite inventive visual things, but he's not particularly concerned about the, you know, the some narrative and the generic elements are what allowed him to get the resources to make a feature film. And so, is it perhaps that some of the specific details are very quite carefully and kind of delicately achieved, but perhaps the more abrupt and the more abrupt disjunctions of things in the film as a whole and sort of apparent inconsistencies perhaps don't necessarily conceal a hidden method behind the madness, but possibly are just a little bit bonkers.
Yeah, but we wouldn't go as far as to say it doesn't have an overarching story, because there's the kind of the idea that the witch is consuming these women of marriageable age.
It does make, that's true.
There is a reason to dwell on the kind of their kind of youth.
Yeah. No. I mean, with some exceptions like the pile of bananas, I think it makes narrative sense. It just doesn't quite make stylistic or tonal sense, or it doesn't appear to. And then, yeah, the question of whether it's handling the transitions in such a way that it's doing something with this, you know, disorientating collection of leaps. And I think I'm genuinely undecided. I think possibly it's just not completely successful. But I think it's more successful for the first sort of half, or possibly two-thirds of the film.
In terms of sort of cohesion, you can see a sort of an idea developing, and it feels like it all comes together, and there's some kind of mastery of technique and
in terms of like sort of how interesting the sort of visual invention is. I think the most interesting things happen in the first part of the film, and then just in terms of how how it manages this kind of balance between, yeah, the narrative and then just the gratuitousness of having spectacular or weird things happening for their own sake. Mm. And
well, according to the production history, the executive of Toho Studios agreed with you, and when he received the script, said it was absolutely well, something worse to the effect of it didn't make any sense.
No, but like you say,
but
it does make sense. Yeah. The narrative does make sense,
and don't try to make it any sense, because I like it as it is. And
yeah,
the maybe it is a film that's that has a sort of cult following because it has set pieces and moments.
Yeah.
That you remember afterwards, and that you want to revisit.
So this is kind of slightly glib, but I've been sort of developing these questions of how much it's in control of what I've been sort of formulating the question of is it actually a really interesting film which looks like a kind of trashy accident, or is it actually a trashy accident which somehow accidentally gives the impression of being a much more interesting film than it actually is? And I think I'm still genuinely undecided.
I think the film has different modes. Mm-mm. And I think that there are moments where it does feel like it's doing trashy on purpose, and then it's doing melodrama and sentimentality on purpose, and the techniques are there to kind of back both of those kind of styles. But I think one thing to say about this film is how fast the cutting becomes especially towards the end. It becomes difficult to actually get a hold on what's happening in a sequence, let alone what sort of techniques are being used, because there's often a sort of flurry of things happening all at once. There's like animation layered on top of sort of various aerial combat and gore and the kind of plastic feel of the horror.
I wonder if actually my personal feeling is the control of the rhythmic, I mean, sort of the rhythmic control of the film, sort of as a whole, is actually stronger than it is with the music. I wonder whether the music, we haven't really talked about the music, but that's also, again, very deliberately. I mean, there's music almost all the way through, and there's particular themes which recur. There's kinds of melodies, theme which he plays on the piano, and there's a particular thing for kung fu whenever she gets into martial arts mode and sort of other things, and again it's deliberately intrusive and excessive, but I don't know if I can just, but I find it in places irritating in a way that I don't find the visual elements sort of irritating. I find the sort of excess of the visuals kind of satisfying in its own terms.
I don't like how often the main theme is repeated. That got on my nerves. But that's just repetition being irritating. I like the soundtrack for the most part. It's just that repetition, I suppose.
Mm.
I even like the sort of incongruous ending sequence where you have that, it's almost sort of, I'm not sure how I'd describe it, almost goes into like disco or something, the kind of the wrapping up sequence where,
well, the final song is almost sort of Beach Boys / Motown / I don't know, I mean, there's some, or there's all sorts of, yeah, I wonder actually if I'm just thinking aloud now if I actually would like the soundtrack to be even more excessive. I mean, not in terms of how much there is of it, but just in the actual musical material. I feel like the musical material is kind of, it has an excess, but it's very much a kind of, it's not actually musically as crazy as it is visually. And I think it would be quite fun actually if the music was, that's actually kind of crazier as music,
Right.
I suppose the big problematic thing with the film, which is quite serious, is its kind of view of, you know, the sort of sexualized young girls, which I'm not sure there's an obvious case to be made in its defense. Well, the first time I saw it, I thought at the beginning, I was like, this is interesting because they're not actually being as sexualized as they could have been. But I thought that in the first sort of 20 minutes. And then by the end of the film, I was like, yeah.
Yeah.
I got that one rather wrong.
Yeah.
And that, of course, aside from the problems of that sort of in its own right, it means you're not really... it's looking at all its protagonists rather than sort of being with them.
Yes, yeah. Well, I suppose there's the body horror element. So there's a sort of rationale there for dismemberment and kind of the body being on display as a kind of shocking. I suppose it becomes an object towards the end, actually. Mm. It's sort of a piece of the furniture, the way it interacts with the house, is quite terrifying. But some of the sort of camera angles seem quite sort of leering, and
yeah, there's quite a lot of upskirt shots, and
that can be quite uncomfortable, I think, from a spectator's point of view.
And I think it sort of makes you feel the film's sort of gratuitousness, and that's something that is sort of evident from the very beginning, just in, you know, things like the frame within the frame and the sort of, you know, flashy techniques we talked about earlier. But yeah, it gives the impression that it's sort of interrogating, you know, not interrogating is probably a bit too strong, but that it has some sort of awareness of gratuitousness as an aesthetic strategy, and it's, you know, at least doing things with it, which then when that gratuitousness is extended to, you know, shots of naked young girls in the bath, becomes quite hard to see that the film, you know, that one could separate out the sort of the different kinds of gratuitousness in the film and say, okay, well, it has some lapses there, but it's doing other things. It seems to me then it makes you... or makes me inclined to see the film's gratuitousness in general as less interesting. So it might be successful in some instances and not in others, but it rather undermines the sense I had earlier in the film that it's sort of deploying it to interesting ends. It seems to be... It makes me more want to conclude that it's simply being gratuitous.
Yeah. I probably agree with you.
But yeah, there is, and isn't it in terms of how they, how it's performed as well. I mean, there's a sort of range of kind of qualities of acting, I think, but some of them have a quite sort of have a sort of exuberant kind of naturalness, which actually works quite well because it's not sort of archly kind of gesturing towards the absurdities of the film. Or
I think staging the lighting just adds to the character's appeal, usually, you know, the horizontal staging where outside the school at the start of the film where you have the main actors all sat in a line, and Bashi has a kind of iris highlight each character, or he'll pan across the row of characters. You know, or he'll use lighting to highlight a particular character, you know, thinking about where Fantasy notices that Melody is becoming sort of entranced by the music that she's playing, and she's sort of centrally staged, and Fantasy can't get her to turn around, and it, you know, creates some sort of tension and some kind of, I don't know. It makes the horror more believable.
Yeah.
And we should probably talk about the production design a bit as well. Just thinking about sort of the craftsmanship of the mm-hmm. film, because it is a film about a house. Mm-hmm. And there are some detailed touches. It looks great on the... Is this a Blu-ray?
Yeah.
So we're watching it on Blu-ray as well. But the sort of the cobwebs and some of the intricacies. Mm-hmm. I mentioned mm-hmm. the horrifying clock moment earlier, where I think it's Sweetie, but it might not be.
No, yes.
Appears in the clock, and you have these turning cogs and you know, blood pouring down, and it
there's a sort of, perhaps as it were, a sort of surprising amount of of things achieved through, you know, pro-filmic effects and devices.
It speaks to what you were saying about the film having these moments, because it seems these are set pieces that have been thought out, and they would have had to have been planned quite far in advance to, you know, well, just to get the mechanism of the clock working you know, make sure that your actors are all lined up for the shot, and, you know.
I mean, everyone has to come to it, I guess one doesn't, come to some sort of judgment. I think, now having seen it twice, I'm inclined to the opinion that, so it's not, I would say, I reckon it's not at all really kind of haphazard and throwing things at the wall and seeing what sticks. It sort of maybe, you know, deliberately wants to create that impression, you know, sort of madcapness, but it does, there's a great deal of thought and care behind a great deal of the film, but I'm not sure if it's fully in control of itself overall, and so I'm not sure that it's a sort of lost or, you know, a hidden or misunderstood kind of masterpiece. I feel that it, sort of some of the more sort of fundamental kind of contradictions and inconsistencies are perhaps are just that.
I think there are sequences that are meant to be disorienting, and some effort has been made to make them so, you know. I already mentioned the layering of effects. You know, those. I think those are intentionally there to make you feel like, you know, the house is falling apart, and the witchcraft is sort of invading the minds of these characters, and I can see that working. Sequences that are bizarre, but I think again they're probably they are kind of meant to be bizarre almost.
And I'm sure. Yeah.
You know, the man being transformed into bananas.
Oh yeah.
And how that comes sort of in the kind of final third of the film, where situation is quite dire, and some of the characters have died in quite morbid ways. You know, almost a bit of like light relief.
Yeah.
That feeds into that idea of it being more a teen flick, but.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not to say horror films are completely devoid of humour. In fact, you know, I think
not at all.
Part of why they're so enjoyable is that precisely that sort of highlighting
how
carefully the kind of craft of horror works on you.
And in some ways, this film is more interesting than some other examples I might think of sort of the comedy horror, precisely because it doesn't reassure you about how you should be feeling. Or it doesn't sort of manage things very carefully to say, oh, here's something funny. Ah, but no, you're now going to be frightened, or vice versa. It, again, the fact that it is disorientating. I definitely agree that this sort of conflict of tones is. No, I didn't mean to imply that was entirely accidental. I think that's very deliberate. But I mean, sort of going beyond that, then to go sort of does the way, the different ways that it's disorientating. You follow on from one another. Does it sort of ultimately achieve something fully, fully coherent, even in its sort of apparent incoherence? And I'm not quite sure. I think it does. But
one thing is how the subtleties, maybe when looked at a bit closer, can seem part of the kind of the overall sort of, I wouldn't call it structure, but bigger ideas in the film. So clockwork keeps coming up time and again, you know. It seems to be part of the rhythm of the film. I think it's because music is important, but you have the metronome, and you have melody, Sweetie caught in the clocks, and you also have the dancing skeleton.
Yes. Although why Sweetie is caught in a clock when she's been pummeled to death by futons is unclear to me.
I know, but it doesn't work when you think about it in that logical sort of way, but it kind of echoes other images and sounds that I've seen, and I suppose at that moment there's some kind of heightening of tension as well by the kind of way in which the clocks are turning, and I don't know, the idea of a sort of a countdown or a sort of I don't know.
Maybe. I'm not sure I'm fully convinced of this.
No, I'm not sure I'm convincing myself of this. This is going to sound really bizarre, but when watching this, I really enjoyed it on a technical level, just because of the amount of things that are going on. I mean, it's a delight for the eyes, isn't it, really? And I couldn't help but think of Abel Gantzen in that kind of category of like pioneer director and Napoleon.
Wow. Yeah, yeah.
And the kind of range of devices that were used, you know, the changing the aspect ratio and having several screens and having...
Well, there is this exuberance. You talked about exuberance in the character. There's exuberance in the film. And so maybe, you're asking the wrong question to go to look for other meaning. Perhaps that's...
What I would really like to do is sit down and rewatch those moments that I did enjoy, like the opening sequence, and some things we haven't mentioned, like when the angel is recounting her auntie's backstory, and they're watching a reel of watching that unfold on a reel of film, and they're all responding in such a way as to suggest that they're in a cinema, this is not angels, these are not angels' thoughts. This is a kind of shared. Yeah. Sort of collective thought, or just a shared space in which they're viewing history unfold and they're commenting on it. So there are all sorts of... I'd love to really down those moments and kind of unpick them and honestly ask myself what kind of emotions it brings up and what kind of ideas. Mm. But there is so much going on that the word virtuosity just doesn't seem quite right, because virtuosity suggests kind of some level of control or some
it's control about relationships, because the actual the effect or the visual content is controlled, even if it's extreme. But the bit when it seems like they're watching a film, and then there's even is really fascinating, and so they're talking about memories, and they talk about things they can see, and then when the film at one point burns up, gets sort of caught in the gate, and they mention that there's reference to it's burning, but then it becomes... It seems that sort of diegetically we're supposed to think that they're showing each other photos in the back seat of a bus. So, but then it seems it would be the wrong question to ask exactly what is this film doing with diegetics status. But it moves you through things.
Yeah, like a commercial. It's a layering of different kind of
transitions. I think maybe that's the other because then it's very shortly after that sequence that we get the thing we were talking about them in front of the painted mountains, which then turns out to be in front of the, as it were, real mountains, which are still obviously painted. I mean, I think maybe that's what I feel later on in the film. I feel some of the transitions are not as interesting as that. Yeah, there's this sort of... There is still a sort of madcap logic of following through, even if it's just the rug being pulled out from under you in the first part of the film, which I feel maybe some of the excitement of that isn't quite sort of... doesn't remain quite as inventive in the transitions later on as it does at the beginning.
Mm. I think you can get a lot out of it just by the fact that it is so different on a kind of tonal level and has so many... And in other words, the kind of strangeness of it is largely internal and has to do with form and it has to do with tone. I'm not saying that if I knew lots about the production context that it would feel more familiar. Mm. You know, it might be... Might still be a sort of curate. Is it a curate's egg? I think.
I think it is a curate's. I think that's right. I think I would. It's a curate's egg.
Yeah.
I would agree with that.